Well, Eric is our regular teacher on Sunday mornings, but he and his family are out of town, so he asked me to speak or teach the class this morning. Rather than starting a new subject, I'm going to let Eric do that. Instead, we'll be talking about basically some highlights that he's been discussing through his class so far. One of the big take-home ideas for me is when we look at church history, and by the way, that's the subject we've been studying, when we look at church history, we can see how something that God created was transformed into something that God certainly did not create. And that's the big message of a study of church history, is looking at the design for the church that you see in the Bible and the very slow but deliberate process of transforming that institution into a different institution altogether. And the interesting thing about that is that shouldn't be anything surprising at all, because what were some of the things that the apostles talked about? Think of the apostle Paul, for example, as he was nearing his time of death. What were some of the things that he was conveying to the church about how the church would change?
Apostasy was coming.
Yeah. And, you know, this isn't necessarily a real positive thing to be thinking about, but it's definitely something that's true, and it's important that we understand it. This is sort of a cliched statement, but it's absolutely true, and it's important that we understand it, especially in the context of the church, that if we don't understand history, history is bound to repeat itself, right? I don't think I said that exactly right, but you get the idea. I used to make fun of people when I was in college, that people that were history majors, because what's the only thing you can do if you're a history major? You can teach history, right? That's it, essentially. And were you a history teacher, Karen?
Yes, I was.
Okay.
That's all I can teach.
Right. Well, my point was, though, that's actually extremely valuable, right? It's so important that we understand the history of the church. Because if we don't understand it, we will do the same thing again. And really, that's the story of the church, essentially. That the church and just God's people in general have gone through the same cycles over and over and over again. So the apostle said that an apostasy would occur. And let's just briefly look at some of those passages. We don't even need to turn there, but what are some of the scriptures you can think of where the Bible teaches us that the church would be corrupted?
Acts 20:29.
Sure.
Greatest wolves,
one man among them. Yep. And so that's when Paul is talking to the Ephesian elders. And where would that apostasy start? Inside or outside the church?
Inside.
Right. It would start inside the church. Not that external influences weren't important, but really, the corruption of the church would start from people inside the church. What are some other passages that come to mind when you think of the apostasy of the church? Well, let me ask this question first. What were some of the apostasies that were already taking place while the Bible was being written? So before we even get to the point where the apostles are prophesying about more apostasy, what were some of the false teachings that existed during the time of the apostles?
Well, not necessarily false teaching, but one thing I think of is Diotrephes was basically throwing people out of the church if they didn't adhere to exactly what he wanted, and that goes along with the system of a ultimate authority in one person, and that, you know, gradually progressed into the Pope.
Right.
So, I mean, that in and of itself, on an individual basis, is how that kind of stuff starts.
Sure, exactly. And, you know, I don't know if Diotrephes really made any major contributions to the development of the apostasy, but you're right, Mike. That idea, people who are hungry for power instead of hungry for the truth, that's what happens. Is they'll do anything to accumulate power, and that's obviously what Diotrephes was doing. Let me give you an example of a false teaching, an apostasy that was definitely going on. When you think of the Galatian church, what was their major problem?
Going back to the old law.
Yeah, there were Judaizing teachers there. They were teaching that you had to obey elements of the Mosaic law.
Second Thessalonians chapter 2.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, in that passage, Paul says that before the day of the Lord comes, a falling away will come first. Then he goes on to describe the man of sin, the son of perdition, And that's a very good point. It's really describing an organized apostasy, which is really what I think we've been talking about in Eric's class. So the Galatians, their major problem was with Judaizing teachers. But then when you read the Colossian letter, there was definitely some Judaizing going on, but the pagan influence was probably more important to the Colossians. Remember how Paul tells them to dismiss those who encourage the worship of angels and those kind of things? I feel like that's probably something that has its origins in paganism. If you go over to 2 Timothy chapter 2, there was two people, and they were teaching something that was false. And Paul says that their message would spread like cancer. Do you remember what it was that they were teaching? Hymenaeus and Philetus. They were teaching that the resurrection was already past. And, you know, that was just, for them to say that, obviously represented a very essential misunderstanding of God's teaching. So those were some of the things that were going on, even while the apostles were alive. And then the apostles, of course, go on to prophesy about more false teaching that would enter the church. And like Kevin mentioned from Ephesians chapter 20, much of that apostasy would originate from inside the church. Yeah, very good. That's the other one I meant to mention. Yeah, even at the time of the apostles, Gnosticism was really the other major influence. So there was the Judaizers, the pagan influence, and then the Gnostic influence was really another form of paganism. That's definitely a very strong influence in the first century and in the later centuries. So we know that the apostles prophesied that there would be apostasy in the church. But what did that look like? What did that look like? What were the things that immediately started to change? And some of those things were already in the process of changing while Paul was speaking on those subjects.
It usually starts with the leadership.
Right, and it did. So the church was established in 30 AD. John, the last apostle, died in around 96 AD. And then as early as, I'm going to put 110 as the date, there was a writer, I don't think I'm going to spell his name right, his name is Ignatius. Ignatius was someone who wrote in the very early 2nd century, and he wrote several letters. He wrote at least 6 letters, and we've got versions of those letters. And one of the recurring themes in his letters is to submit to the council of elders and to submit to the bishop. Isn't that interesting that as early as 110 AD, now in my opinion, I think those letters have some forgery involved. I think at least portions of those letters were probably forged by the apostate church, more like in the 3rd or 4th century. But nonetheless, the idea definitely existed at the time of Ignatius in about 110, where he was teaching people not only to submit to the elders, but also submit to the bishop. So in basically less than a decade, or just more than a decade after the last apostle's death, the church had already transformed on some level. People were giving up on the idea that a plurality of elders was sufficient to lead a church, and they'd started identifying individual people to be the leaders of congregations.
And wasn't that from the church of Jerusalem or not? Isn't that where that kind of started?
Yes and no. Eric talked about this in his class. Part of the thing that led up to the idea of bishops, and I think this is what you're talking about, Mike, is smaller congregations, if they had issues, they would just defer to the larger congregations to let their leadership make those decisions. And that was sort of the beginning of the hierarchical system, where individual congregational autonomy, they just gave up on it. They didn't. The smaller congregations felt like, well, we've got this issue, let's let one of the big churches make the decision for us. And so that was at Jerusalem or Antioch or Alexandria. Dwayne?
And that was quite appropriate when the apostles were here.
Sure, yeah.
Because that's where the authority was.
Right.
And it happened to be, most of them happened to be at Jerusalem. That's why we had the Council of Jerusalem in the Bible.
Yeah, exactly.
But that's not a pattern for
right
what we should do.
And I think we all understand that. the apostles had authority over the entire church. I mean, Bob and Duane, do you have any authority over any other church other than this congregation? Absolutely not. You know, and one thing that can seem to get sticky sometimes is if we have, you know, evangelists here at this congregation and that evangelist is working at another congregation, Bob and Duane still don't have any authority at that congregation. It would only be the evangelist that has the authority there at that place. So that was the first thing to change, was the government of the church. And like Mike brought up, some of that is just the human nature. We tend to make things more complicated, not less complicated. And some of that was just because people were more hungry for authority and power than they were hungry for the truth. It's interesting to note some of the next few big things that started to happen, but I'm going to let you mention some of them. What are some of the other big changes you see happening very early in the history of the church?
We talked a little bit about the use of holy water.
Yeah, and that's the next one I was going to mention. So this is in about 120. About 120, there was a teaching that was born and obviously grew at a rapid pace, that the waters of baptism had to be blessed and holy in some way. And Eric made this point during his class, and I think it's a good point. How would someone read the Bible and come to the conclusion that the waters of baptism must be blessed and holy for them to do their job? Well, Clayton's shaking his head, and that's because you can't read the Bible and come to that conclusion.
Actually, what you see is the opposite.
Right.
You see how Naaman was cleansed in the Jordan River, John the Baptist baptized in the Jordan River, and it was muddy.
Right. You know, and the story of Naaman is really interesting, because what was his hang-up? Why did he wait so long to do what Elijah told him to do? Because he thought the water needed to be special, basically. He said, why am I going to go wash myself in this dirty Jordan River when I've got these great waters in my own place that I could do this? And it's simple. God just wants us to do what he wants us to do, despite our own ideas. So, and this is really, to me, the big story of the apostasy. This is the story of the apostasy, is when someone gives up on the authority of the Bible and the sufficiency of the Bible. So I'm going to make a statement, and just think about if you agree with this or not. God's plan is complete and perfect. Can you agree with that? Does God's plan need any additions or revisions? Yes or no? It does not. And if we believe that, then being a Christian is very simple. You just live by the Bible, and that's it. And that is it. It doesn't have to be more complicated than that. Now, of course, there's times where we have to make judgment decisions, but that's just what they are. They're decisions based on judgments, sometimes based on our own conscience. But as far as the structure of the church, as far as the nature of the Christian faith, we have to believe that the Bible is sufficient, it's perfect, it needs no revisions or additions.
Matt,
yes?
I think we can see within all of these different things that you're starting to mention, there's some other subtle and very powerful thing behind all of that. And that is the devil has been stripped of some of his power. When Christ died and then was resurrected, that took away from Satan some of his power.
Mm-hmm.
So now he's out there, and all of this is coming from him. He's out there causing men to elevate themselves into authority, as you've said. And the holy water, who's behind that? That's some man that says, I need to make the water holy for you.
Right.
And all of these other things. That man, it boils it down so that it makes it easier for one man to control
right.
the church.
That's a really interesting point. Yeah, because eventually the church got to the point where there was only special people who could even do the blessing of the water. So, and I always think that the subject of holy water is such an important subject to start with, first because it was one of the first diversions from the truth, and then, you know, there's all these it just sort of epitomizes all of the issues that we can talk about when it comes to apostasy. Like Dwayne said, it starts to centralize authority. And the biggest issue to me is it represents a fundamental misunderstanding of one of the most important topics of the Bible. Because if someone believes that the water itself has to be holy, do they really understand baptism? I don't think so. And so that's what happens with these kind of teachings.
And then if you believe the water's holy, what about the person baptizing you? Don't they have to be holy?
Sure.
What about the building you're in? What, you know, and it, there's no end to that.
It does, and that's exactly right. Once you,
that's what we see today.
You take that first step away from the truth, even if it seems harmless on the surface, it opens Pandora's box. And what we see in the development of the apostasy is it was one small step at a time until, like the Bible says, you have a monster created. A few other things that were going on about this time. I don't have the exact date, but a date that we can put on it is around 200 or so A.D. is when people started to baptize children. In fact, around 200 A.D. and a little after, most writers that we read about were actually teaching that children must be baptized, which again represents a fundamental departure from one of the most basic teachings of the Bible. And there were some people who were opposed to that. Tertullian was one man who, in his writings of the second century, resisted the baptism of children, but in general, that became a very common popular theme right away. About the same time in 200 A.D., we have a change in the language that the church was using, which later would become important. About 200 A.D., elders stopped being called elders, and what did they start calling themselves?
Priests.
Right now, you're right that in many cases, as the hierarchy was spread out, there were people who called elders, people called presbyters, people called metropolitans, people called bishops. But the elders in particular assumed the title of priest. What's wrong with that statement? I mean, exactly. Is Dwayne a priest? Yes. Is Bob a priest? Yes. But everybody else is also a priest on some level. So it had the same effect again of separating, and really what was going on was the separation of the clergy and the laity, which just a simple language change made major contributions to that confusion. Something else going on about this time in the early 3rd century. So in 220, a man named Origen, however you want to say it, he was the first to teach the idea of purgatory. And what is that? Or I guess I should say, what do people say it is? What is purgatory?
A waiting place of neither punishment or reward.
Right. I haven't studied it a whole lot, but the way I understand it is it's essentially a place where people go if they're not bad enough to go to hell, but not good enough to go to heaven. And that's probably a really poor description of what people actually teach, but that's essentially the idea. And so that kind of leads me to the same question we said before. How does someone read the Bible and come to the conclusion that someone can die, go to this neutral waiting place, without their judgment being determined? Because the next step in that teaching is you pray people out of purgatory. Right? How do you read the Bible and come to that conclusion?
Well, that's just it. They have to get people away from the Bible,
right,
to get them to believe this.
Yeah, and eventually that's what happened. That's what we'll talk about. Within a few hundred years, the language of the Bible was transformed almost entirely to Latin, and there was actually a point where the clergy of the apostate church made it illegal, essentially, for the laity to read the Bible. They weren't even supposed to read it. And it's no wonder, because if someone could read the Bible, they would know what the Bible actually said. So there was a lot going on around in the 3rd century. So here's another one that we'll write up here. 250 is when you see sprinkling occurring for the first time. And here's another one that I find especially interesting. I don't know, you probably, most people probably can't read what's on the board, but in 313, the doctrine of celibacy was introduced. Let's go over to 2 Timothy, or 1 Timothy chapter 4. Everyone's probably familiar with this passage, but it's still worth reading. First Timothy chapter 4. And could someone please read verses 1 through 3?
Now the Spirit expressly says that in latter times some will depart from the faith, giving heed to deceiving spirits and doctrines of demons, speaking lies and hypocrisy, having their own conscience seared with a hot iron, forbidding to marry, and commanding to abstain from foods which God created to be received with thanksgiving by those who believe and know the truth.
Very good. So Paul says the same thing that he says in other places in the Bible, that an apostasy in the church was imminent. And he also says what that apostasy would look like. He names two specific things that, at least in this place, were meant to identify the apostasy. And what were those two issues?
Forbidding marriage.
Yeah, one was forbidding marriage and commanding to abstain from foods which God created to be received. And I really appreciate when God does this. He doesn't always do this, but in this case, he's very specific. Paul says there will be an apostasy, and here's two things that you will see that can help you to identify the apostasy. One of them is that people are going to start telling you that you can't eat certain foods. And then the other thing is that there's going to be commandments to abstain from marriage. Now, there's probably an argument that someone could make that those two issues don't refer to the apostate church, but it sure sounds like it does. In what way did the apostate church fulfill the first comment about, or the second thing about commanding to abstain from foods? Right. Right. Which you might think, why is that such a big deal? Who cares if the leadership of a church tells their members to stop eating certain foods at certain times? Well, the reason it matters is because it wasn't just on the congregational level. It was something that was institutionalized. Lent became very much an institutional observation. And it was just an example of the clergy demonstrating their authority over the churches. And they did have authority over the churches. They were doing whatever they wanted. They were supplementing the Bible however they felt like they could supplement it. And Paul here is telling us that, number one, that's not a teaching that comes from God. And then secondly, he basically says that doesn't make any sense anyway. God gave you this food to eat it, so eat it. And then the other thing is what we're talking about specifically, and that's the subject of celibacy. That there would be a teaching forbidding to marry. And in my mind, it makes sense to associate this with the commandment of the apostate church that priests should remain celibate. What are some other things, though, that might be related to that teaching?
My neighbor, who's a Catholic, thinks it's a real crime that they got away from the heavenly language of Latin.
Oh, that's interesting.
And that's upsetting to her. That the service is now in English.
That's interesting.
She said that's...
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I obviously didn't ask my question very well. So I think that when Paul says here that there would be commands to forbid from marriage, I think it's connected to celibacy that was commanded towards the priests. But someone could make the argument that it's not about celibacy and the priesthood, it's about this, something else. Well, what are some of the other things that people could argue that passage relates to? I've heard a few of these before. So one is in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, Paul talks about how he wishes other people could be like him. And there's been various times through the history of the church that people have taught that you should not marry. And so it's possible that Paul's talking about that. In any case, I guess the real point is I think it's talking about when the clergy of the church or commanded to be celibate.
Along that line, when you talk about the other forbidding certain foods, you know, people could make the argument, well, what about fasting?
Yeah.
You know, people fasted in the Old Testament and in the New Testament, but, you know, what you have to know the Bible and understand the Bible to know the truth, and the truth about that fasting is that's a voluntary thing. It's on an individual basis. It's not commanded by God or the leadership anymore. And the reason for that was so a person could concentrate more on God and scriptural things and become closer. And it's not picking and choosing certain foods. Fasting was just to stop eating altogether for a period of time.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And there was an example of Jesus doing that. But it's two different things, and an unlearned person just reading the Bible or having a person that believes in that try to force that on them without reading the Bible and studying the Bible will probably accept it.
Right. And to me, that brings up another point that we sort of made already, and it's just that some of these issues, in and of themselves, all by themselves, don't seem like that big of an issue. But when you take the whole picture all together, you have an institutionalized corruption of the church, where power is taken from the Bible, taken from God, and then given to a small group of people. One of the things that I find so interesting about 3:13 and the command for celibacy, not only is that a teaching that's foreign to the Bible, it's also a teaching that is perfectly against the teachings of the Bible, isn't it? Because what does the Bible teach about leadership in the church? Yeah. Yeah, which is, to me, so important to acknowledge here. The Bible actually teaches that leadership in the church must be married. And as human beings, we can see the value in that. A man that is unmarried, but a leader in the church, is going to lack the ability to relate to a lot of issues that a leader has to deal with in the church. And so for the apostate church to command the idea of celibacy is not only foreign to the Bible, it's actually completely opposed to one of the basic teachings we read about leadership in the church.
That first verse in the fourth chapter is so important because that gives you the two elements that lead to apostasy. And number one is departing from the faith.
Right.
And the second one is giving heed to seducing spirit or to deceivers.
Right, right. Very good. So a few more highlights as far as the history of the church and some of the things that led to apostasy. And this is one that I would say is one of the big ones. This is in 325. All of these are big issues, but certainly some of these are bigger issues than others. So in 325, we have the Council of Nicaea. And the result of that is the Nicene Creed. Can anyone give me any context on this period? Constantine was responsible for organizing this, but what was really the subject?
Who Jesus was.
Yeah, that was essentially the subject. Someone correct me if I'm explaining this incorrectly, but here's how I understand it. At this time, there was essentially two schools of thought. There was the mainstream school of thought, which we would actually agree with, that God and the Father and the Holy Spirit are three parts of the same entity, right? Well, there was the other school of thought, which I think, I'm saying this correctly, was the Arian school of thought. And the Arians taught that Jesus was not God. And some people took it even to the extent that Jesus in his bodily form was not divine at all. So I may not be representing that perfectly, but you can see the issue. There was different ideas on who Jesus even was. And so the solution in the mind of Constantine was to form this council of important church leaders and let them make the decision, right? What is wrong with that?
Well, you know, what they're doing is taking the power away from Christ.
Right.
Saying he wasn't divine, so he's just another man. So we as men can get together and decide these things ourselves.
Right.
And that's what they were putting themselves up.
That would be a politically expedient thing for him to do at the time.
Sure. Yeah, it certainly was.
He would recognize that they were more experts on the subject. It's what it's what people do today on a lot of things, and it's not wrong, but when it comes to religion, it is.
Right.
He was just consolidating all what he thought was the best minds to say, okay, you got to get in the room and come up with the answer.
Right. And what's the basic problem with calling a group of people together to make a decision on a spiritual subject like that? Does anyone, does any council, does any group of people have the authority to make a theological decision on what the Bible means? And does that decision have any kind of authority? I would say absolutely not.
Within each congregation by themselves.
Right. Within congregations, we have an obligation to make those kinds of decisions. But for people from various congregations to make an institutionalized decision that's supposed to be authoritative towards all churches, absolutely something that's outside of the Bible. Go ahead, Kevin.
Dan, you had also asked about the context of that. And of course, the context involved Constantine himself, who had now deemed Christianity to be the religion of the state, in essence. And one of the things he essentially did was establish himself to be the head of the church.
Sure.
As he's able to call the council, and as they, I mean, yes, he's brought the experts together, but that's part of the context here, too.
Right. So I do want to get to that in just a moment. But one more comment on the Nicene Creed and the Nicene Council. If I understand this correctly, and I may not, but if I do understand it correctly, the result... Well, let me just read the Nicene Creed. Let's just read the Nicene Creed. It's pretty short. So this was the statement that came out of that council. We believe in one God, the Father Almighty, maker of all things, both visible and invisible, and in one Lord, Jesus Christ, the Son of God, begotten by the Father, begotten, that is to say, of the substance of the Father, God of God, light of light, very God of very God, begotten, not made, being of one substance with the Father, by whom all things were made, both things in heaven and things on earth, who for us men and our salvation came down and was made flesh, made man, suffered and rose again on the third day and went into the heavens, and is so to come again to judge both the quick and the dead and in the Holy Ghost. I agree with that statement. That statement is true, actually. But you don't need a statement like that because God says the same thing in the Bible, right? So the result of that council was a statement that is true. But you can't, you've heard this before, you can't justify the end by the means, right? And the means, this council, was something that is against the teachings of the Bible. It took authority away from individuals and from individual congregations and gave it to some institutionalized council that was assumed to have the authority to make those kinds of decisions. And although this statement happened to be true, this established pattern of having a council to make institutional church decisions started a trend that eventually completely destroyed the church. This first statement was true, but the decisions of many councils that came afterward were absolutely not true at all. And that's where much false doctrine originated, was in these councils where people were assumed to have the authority to establish church doctrine. So that's the problem. Church councils don't establish church doctrine. God already established church doctrine in the Bible. And any time we try to supplement that, that's when we've left the Bible completely. So any comments or questions on that? So like I said, this was a big one that I understand to be a major turning point for the church. When people came to believe that you could appoint special people to make decisions about what the Bible means. That's essentially what happened there. Joe?
Since Constantine was the ruler, this is where church and government started twisting together. And then all of a sudden, if you don't abide by the decision of these councils, then that was a persecution.
Yeah, exactly. So that's the other big thing that I really see as a turning point in the history of the church. I mean, all of these things are on their own some kind of turning point. But the Council of Nicaea and then this fusion of church and state that was initiated by Constantine and then really finalized by the Emperor Justinian, this was a major issue as well. When the church and the state essentially became one authority together. And by the 6th century, Justinian, the emperor of Rome, just turned over. He essentially turned over the empire to the papacy. And that was sort of going on already, but he made it official. He declared, essentially, that the Pope was not just the leader of the church, but the leader of the empire.
That's what is happening today in the Muslim world, like in Iran. You know, they have an elected president, but he's not the supreme authority. The supreme authority is the Ayatollah,
right,
who is their religious leader.
Right. And this is just a basic idea in the Bible, that there is the church and there is the state. They're different. They're not the same. In the Bible, it's always us and them. And so it's important that we keep it that way. I would say, milestone in the apostasy of the church started in around 450. And that was prayer to Mary. And this is another one of those subjects that to me is just confusing. And also I'll ask the same question again. How does someone read the Bible and come to the conclusion that you can pray to Mary and that's somehow useful to you, or try to pray through Mary and that's somehow useful to you? Ben?
I think that if we were to ask that question today, that we would be told, well, of course the Bible doesn't say that.
But, right.
But this person or these people through the ages, who they're the spokesman for God and God made some updates.
Well, I would say yes. In fact, prayer to Mary was something that was established by the Council of Chalcedon. And so that's actually another point to be made. That was one of the issues with these councils. Councils didn't, in the beginning, it was assumed that all they did was clarify doctrine, right? But very quickly, they didn't just clarify doctrine, they created doctrine. And so my understanding is that's where prayer to Mary came from. I'm assuming there were people trying to do that sort of thing all along. But it wasn't until 451 in this particular council that the idea of praying to Mary was not just endorsed, but also encouraged as spiritual truth. And so, Ben, I think the answer is yes, that by this time it was understood that these councils and the leadership of the Catholic Church actually had the authority to create doctrine, essentially. That's the way I understand it, anyway.
I just read recently somewhere, that, and I really never heard of it before, that there was a belief that in order for Christ to be perfect, that Mary also had to be.
Yeah.
And that was actually a teaching in the apostate church.
It still is a teaching in the apostate church. Right. So this is a really good example of how one thing that gets confused just leads to this cascade of false doctrine. So where that comes from is the teaching of original sin. So the teaching of original sin says that everyone born is in sin, that and is going to bear the consequence of sin. So if you believe that a little baby born is in sin, what's the next natural step? Well, the next thing you think is, well, you got to get rid of that sin. Well, that's where the idea of infant baptism comes in. But then you start to ask the question, if Jesus was perfect, how does original sin fit with that? So instead of the Catholic Church teaching that Jesus was just born perfect, what they teach is that Mary was born perfect, and then she passed on her perfection to Jesus. It's called the Immaculate Conception of Mary. Is that right? I think that's right, the Immaculate Conception of Mary. So it's that she was born perfect, and then her perfect birth then allowed Jesus to be born perfect, and that's how he was born without sin.
Dad,
yes?
A quick comment, 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 15, knowing how to behave yourself in the house of God, which is the church of the living God, the pillar of the ground and the truth.
Right.
What does it mean the church is the pillar of the ground and the truth? Obviously, the whole reason that Catholics would take the perspective that they can continue to add to it. They're saying that the church has the pillar of the ground.
Can create truth.
We don't produce the truth. We teach the truth that has been produced.
Right. Yeah, we're a foundation for truth to grow, and we're a pillar that holds up the truth, but we're not the origin of truth. So thank you. Thank you for your time and attention. We'll take about a 5-minute break.